Welcome to the Psychology Games Podcast, where you learn about how psychology and video games interact to shape our behaviors, our beliefs, and our purchasing decisions. My name is Jamie Madigan, a psychology PhD and a lifelong gamer. I write, podcast, and lecture about this stuff on psychologyofgames.com, and I'll be your host. Have you ever wanted to possess knowledge about the psychology of video games in book form? I've written a book about how those who make games and those who sell them use psychology to shape our behavior, manipulate our beliefs, and rig our purchasing decisions. It's called Getting Gamers, The Psychology of Video Games and Their Impact on the People Who Play Them, published by Roman and Littlefield. You can go right now to psychologyofgames.com/book to find out more. Each chapter in the book examines scientific research on psychology, behavioral science, and decision-making to answer questions like, why do normal people become raving lunatics online? Why are fanboys and fangirls so ready for a fight? How do games get us to grind and chase after achievements? How do mobile games get you with in-app purchases and microtransactions? Do video games make you smarter? And many more questions that I bet you've pondered at one time or another. If you like this podcast or the articles on my website, you're going to enjoy it. You and I, we like a good debate. Of course we do. And there's plenty of debate to be found at the intersection of psychology and video games. For example, there's the old chestnut about how violent games are linked to gun violence and other tragedies.
So is there a link between violent video games and these recurring acts of mass killing in our society? Well, the answer may not be as clear-cut as you think. Joining me now, live from Philadelphia, is Dr. Patrick Markey. He's an associate professor of psychology at Villanova University who researches video game violence. Dr. Markey, let's just get right to it. There's been plenty of research out there which shows a link between violent video games and aggression. But can we go so far as to say that playing violent games triggers or leads someone to committing any violent act?
No, it's very difficult to make that kind of claim.
This is a CNN program discussing violent games in the wake of the 2013 shootings at the Washington, D.C. Navy Yard.
There's really no evidence to suggest that such violent media is linked to these shootings or really any real-world violence, that what we find in our laboratory studies are very small effects affecting our thoughts, our cognitions, but not so much affecting our actual real behaviors.
You get the idea. There's also debates about the dangers of video game addiction.
According to one estimate, young Americans spend 10,000 hours playing video games before they turn the age of 21. That's about the same amount of time they spend in the classroom during all of middle school.
This is from a 2011 CBS Morning Show discussing new research about what spending too much time with video games can do to your kids, or anybody's kids.
Nearly 10% of those kids are addicts. Scary numbers for all of us. Jennifer Jolly is tech lifestyle editor at Tekka.com, and here with some advice on helping us navigate those numbers, perhaps bring them down a little bit.
Yeah,
even.
It's scary, isn't it?
Yeah.
How serious?
And so on. And then there's stuff that really seems out of left field, like this.
Gentlemen, welcome. Philip Zimbardo, then. Your book is Man Disconnected. What's your theory?
It's not a theory. It's an alarm. We're sending an alarm that there's a crisis in the making in the UK, in America, in Poland, other countries, where young boys are failing academically, they're failing socially, having no friends, and they're failing sexually. And that's a killer triad. And what we point out is that video games and watching video games to excess in social isolation, and now watching freely available pornography in excess in social isolation, is a killer combination.
That's psychologist Philip Zimbardo, he of the famous Stanford prison experiments, appearing on a BBC news program and saying that video games are combining with other factors to make boys and men something. Impotent? Weirdos? Impotent weirdos who can't make good grades or hold coherent conversations with girls? I don't know. I'll include a link to the whole program if you want to see the whole thing for yourself.
It's a grim picture.
Of course, debate ensued on that BBC program, including this from Andrew Schabowski, who you may remember from his appearance on this podcast.
Think of what Dr. Philip Zimbardo is saying this morning.
Well, I think a lot of what Philip is sharing is pretty much common sense. There are definitely things that we should be keeping our eyes on when it comes to new technologies, but a lot of the critique could have just as easily been applied to rock music or comic books. There's really an issue of causation versus correlation. There might be some people who are predisposed to social isolation who might be playing games alone. But the causal evidence really is not there. We have about 25 years of brain research and large-scale research with young people, boys and girls.
But you know what? Let's not only focus on the twin monsters of addiction and violence. These aren't the only kinds of debates happening around the psychology of video games. Researchers have for years been talking about the effects of different kinds of games on physical health, mental health, social skills, whether or not games improve mental abilities. They talk about how video games facilitate the creation of social groups in ways that are unique among media. They talk about how video games can be used as teaching and learning tools, not just in the classroom, but in the workplace and at the home. You all, there's tons of research about this stuff, and so much of it is cool. Psychologists, communication researchers, and other academics have been studying these topics for years, often building on media researchers who have been active for decades. So why all the debate? Hasn't this stuff been figured out yet? Even in cases where no clear answer has been found, why hasn't the work of these researchers found more of a happy home in the public consciousness? Despite the fact that yo, share your stuff, is one of the central defining tenets of science, academics can be insular. There's a reason why the term ivory tower exists and why it stings so much. Much of the really rigorous scientific research, once it's done, is published in academic journals that are locked behind paywalls. Even then, it's not exactly written with an eye for those working in industry or those in charge of determining policy or coverage. The reward systems in universities are set up to encourage this. You don't get tenure from having a lot of Twitter followers or speaking at the Game Developers Conference. You get tenure by publishing in hoity-toity academic journals. If you're not a professor or a student who has access to a university library that'll pay to get the research and provide you with search tools, you're out of luck if you don't want to pay yourself, despite the fact that so much of this research is funded by government money. This is one of the reasons I started my Patreon campaign, to be able to pay for that access and bring it to you, patreon.com/POG. Wouldn't it be nice if somebody brought together the experts on all these debates and had them share the state of things in clear language that non-experts can understand and use? Well,
there's whole departments that study game studies now, but the gap between what the scientific community knows and what the general population knows was still there. That was kind of the aim of this volume, was to overview the state of the research in a way that was accessible and taking all of the scientific information and disseminating it to a general audience.
In every episode of this podcast, I interview one, sometimes two, experts on the psychology of video games. Today, we're going to talk about the great video game debates of the day and why they aren't always as informed by research as they could be, and what some people are doing about it. All right, thanks everybody for joining me on the interview section of the podcast. Today, I have a twofer, first time with two guests in the interview seat who are going to tell us all about some recent work they've been doing around various debates in social science and elsewhere that are happening around video games and what sense we can make of them. So I've got Rachel Cowart and Torsten Quandt on the line. So each of you, welcome. Thanks for joining us here on the Psychology Games podcast. Why not to kick things off, just kind of tell me who you are and what you're doing here.
Thanks for having us. I guess ladies first.
Sure.
My name is Rachel Cowart. I'm formerly of the University of Munster, where I worked with Professor Quandt on a two-year postdoctoral research post on the SOFAGA project, which looked at the social foundations of online games. I hold a PhD in psychology from the University of York, UK, and a master's in counseling psychology from Santa Clara University. Generally, I'm interested in the various inter and intrapersonal social impacts of digital gameplay and the kind of looking at the antecedents and the consequences of online gameplay.
Okay.
Yeah, my name is Torsten Quandt. I have to admit I'm not a psychologist. I'm a communication scholar.
Oh, no.
Yeah, sorry.
We'll still let you participate. I've had a number of those on before.
Well, I have a minor in psychology, but and I am a professor in Münster, a professor of online communication, and I'm also the chair of the working group Digital Games Research in the European Communication Association. And my research interests are all types of online communication. Games is one of them, but there's also we have some projects on cyberbullying, also online journalism and other things like that.
Okay, great. And you two have recently collaborated on a book that's out in September, if I'm correct. And that's called The Video Game Debate, Unraveling the Physical, Social, and Psychological Effects of Video Games. So somebody want to tell me what that's about? Like, what is that book and who's it aimed at? And what will people get out of it if they read it?
Sure. I'll take the first half. Thorsten can take the second half. This book is really for everyone. I mean, creating a book that was accessible to everyone was really the main motivation behind putting it together. Back in 2005, during the clinical internship of my master's program, I noted a sudden influx of concern about the potential impact of online gaming. So World of Warcraft was just starting to become popular, and you were seeing a lot of people kind of freak out at their children playing an increased amount of World of Warcraft. So my clients, and mostly parents, but sometimes the players themselves, were also expressing similar concerns about how online play may be affecting them or how violent video games may be influencing them somehow. Now, I was also playing World of Warcraft, maybe more than I'd like to admit. So their concerns were starting to kind of concern me. And I was like, well, maybe, you know, this is something that should be looked into. But this was back...
What year was this in?
This was 2005. So Nick Yee, you know, one of the first researchers in this area, he was just getting started. So there was really nothing in this area. But today we have tons of research in this area. I mean, there's whole departments that study game studies now, but the gap between what the scientific community knows and what the general population knows was still there. So that was kind of the aim of this volume, was to overview the state of the research in a way that was accessible and taking all of the scientific information and disseminating it to a general audience.
Yeah, and I think the book is, for us, it was a bit like a dream project because we made a long list of authors and we thought, you know, who do we want to invite? Who are the best authors in that field? And we asked them whether they want to participate. And yeah, whereas to our surprise, most of them said, yes, we want to participate. So it's kind of a really something that I planned for a long time to do a project where really some of the central players in the field, some of the central scientists write articles about their field that are accessible to a general public and not, you know, just some people that are writing about all these scandalous problems that are with games, but really write about scientific knowledge that is accessible for a general audience.
Yeah, looking over the list of contributors, so you all edited this book and then you had individual or pairs of writers come in and write specific chapters, and it's like a who's who of psychology and communications research on video games, like James Ivory, Nicholas Bowman, who's been a guest on this podcast, Cheryl Olson, Chris Ferguson, Mark Griffiths, John Sherry, Sean Green, and a few others. Like I look at those names, I'm like, oh, I know them. I've read their stuff. So it's nice to see them all in one big party.
Yeah, I mean, it was real important to us to get scholars that, you know, were well versed in their individual fields of study.
I think, you know, this list of author, to explain that list of author, you also need to know that there's really a community of researchers out there that is working on digital games for many years now. And I think the public hasn't, you know, or didn't have access to all that knowledge because it happened, you know, a bit in the ivory tower. And people were talking about that research at, you know, at some conventions or meetings, workshops, and so on. And for us, it's important to let the general audience know about that research, because very often in the public, you have some people that claim to be experts on that topic or the field. And actually, they're not, because when you go to a scientific meeting, they're not there, these experts, these public experts.
Yeah, and they've never had their work scrutinized and subjected to the hurdles that academics have to go through to get their work published and recognized and presented and so forth. So, yeah, that's great. I mean, that's kind of the role that I'm trying to take on with my website, is to highlight those researchers and the work they're doing and say, like, hey, here's, you know, here are some answers, here's some data, or at least if not answers, here are some well-crafted questions that we need to look into. So let's just get the plugs out of the way. When is the book available for sale?
September 25th.
Any recommended place people should go?
Well, it is available on Amazon.com and also Barnes & Noble. So either one.
You'll get there.
Yep, you'll get it.
Okay. What are some of the major debates that you tackle in the book?
Well, I think there are the usual suspects are in there as well. I addiction and aggression. But what I think is important about that book is that it also looks at things that are not debated in the public so much, like positive effects, social outcomes of gaming, what you can learn from video games, and all these aspects are a bit invisible in the public debate. So it's really covering the positive and sometimes also negative aspects of video game playing.
We got the big guns or the big debates like around violence and aggression. We've got stuff in there about addiction. And then also, like you said, some of the, like, what are the benefits of playing games? So what's some of the research on that last one?
We have a couple of chapters in the book on positive effects. I think it's more of a recent trend in the literature. So the book is maybe slightly biased at discussing the potential negative impact. But we have a chapter on gaming communities. And we also have a chapter on games and learning.
So gaming communities, is that going to be like your guilds and your message boards or any specific types of communities we're talking about?
So guilds and gaming communities. It's about how your different gaming communities, such as the ones you have offline, like when you're playing co-located with other players, or your guilds that you have online, and how they can provide kind of a sense of social support and social satisfaction and increase your life satisfaction and the different ways they contribute to your overall well-being, which I think is often discredited. I mean, if it is even publicly debated, I think online friends are often seen as somehow less valuable than offline friends. So this chapter kind of really debates that and tries to make a case for online friends, can have some social benefits in your life.
What I think is important about gaming communities is that there's this old idea of a gaming community being something virtual, being separate from the real world. And I think that is a very old idea that is not actually kind of fitting, because the gaming communities are part of the lives of the people that are playing the game. So it's basically, there's no, I think, separation between that part of your life where you are in a game or you meet friends there and the rest of your life. You integrate that into your life. And I think Franz Meyre, who wrote that chapter, is also covering some of that debate about what gaming communities are and that they're not really separated from the so-called real world.
So why do you think that the big topics are so often violence, addiction, in a different way, education, which is usually spun as like a positive, like here's how you use games to teach. But those seem to be the big three that at least most people know about, actually, if you do a survey of the literature, those are the most published on topics. Why is that? Why did those types of topics either perceive to get the majority of the coverage, or why do they get so much coverage?
Well, new media is a good scapegoat. the violence and aggression, you always see this in the headlines whenever something horrible happens. They say, oh, well, they played video games and that must have been a contributor. And I think, all new media tends to kind of fill that scapegoat role when it's still, relatively new and maybe somewhat misunderstood. Elvis's hips were blamed for a lot of things, too. So I think at least in terms of the violent video game and aggression, people say, oh, we have these games. Oh, they're interactive. Oh, they're violent. Never mind that a lot of American media is violent. So I think it's just kind of an easy thing to jump to in terms of that.
And I think if something is new in society, it's normal that a society is first of all looking at the dangers of that to protect, vulnerable parts of society like children and so on. So I think that's totally fine. It's just a question whether there are some kind of moral entrepreneurs out there that, kind of use that as a tool for their own career. I think there's a chapter by Nick Bowman in there that is covering that, looking at the moral panic and how some people actually use that moral panic, around games for their own good. Mm-hmm. And I think that is a problem. If some people are actually not using real research or people that are trying to push their own agenda into, or transfer it into the public agenda. And I think that is, these problematic, these public experts that sometimes do that, for their own good. They kind of make money with it, or their scientific career depends on that. So I think that is not true research in a way, because research should be neutral. I mean, in the end, you can interpret your data, but you shouldn't have the answers before you do the research. And I think that is a big problem with a lot of research in that field, that some people already had the answer before they actually did their research. They said, okay, these games are evil and they make people aggressive. So it was clear that the answer was already there before they did any survey or experiment.
And I won't ask you to name any names.
No.
But I might have a few idea of a few people that you're talking about. So I think that explains, you know, the idea that, or the argument that video games are just sort of the next entry in a line of media that included rock and roll music and comic books and, you know, novels or dime novels, pulp fiction, movies, all that sort of stuff. I guess that explains why, and everything else that you just said explains why the interest is there, and maybe that translates into which research grants get funded or approved or accepted. It also seems to me that there's a lot of cases where somebody might be studying a topic already, like I'm studying addiction in, say, like casinos or any other or type of addiction, and oh, video games have gotten really big lately, so that's sort of like a tool to continue my research in addiction or education or violence, and they just sort of attach onto that as more like a tool and focus on the content of the games, and then less thought is given to around like, well, wait a minute, video games are different from those other types of media, and here's some ways that they're different, and here's some ways that those differences could impact cognitions and emotions and cognitive demands. Another episode of this podcast, I got into a lot more detail with this with Nicholas Bowman, who wrote wrote that chapter on moral panics, and that was sort of his theory, his hypothesis. And I think there's some merit to that.
Oh, absolutely.
But I think the situation is a bit different in Europe now. It was like that some years ago, and the debate was very, it wasn't balanced, I would say. If you had some research on negative effects, it was highly likely that it would get some funding or some interest by society. But I think nowadays it's a bit more balanced, and people are kind of more interested also in the positive effects, and they now understand that games are part of the lives of people and that they won't go away. And I think the US debate is a bit more, it's a bit more political at the moment, which is kind of interesting for us as Germans, because I remember some years ago, everybody was pointing at Germany and saying, oh, they're having that discussion on aggression in video games and they're really strict, you know, in controlling video games. And nowadays it's not like that. It's a bit more, I wouldn't say easygoing, but the debate is a bit more normalized, I would say.
That's interesting. Yeah, so there very could well be regional and cultural differences in what's going on as well. So where are sort of the misalignments between what's going on in academia and the scientific community and what's of interest or what's happening in the mainstream?
Well, I think Thorsten just touched on some of it. I think that the debates in America, like he was saying, are more politicized over here. But I think in the research community, even in America, we've also kind of moved on and said, okay, we've looked at these negative effects, you know, for the last 10, 15 years. And now we're really more interested in how are people using games in their everyday lives? What potential positive ways are they using these games? I think the public debate is very much skewed to the negative, which is understandable. But I think that the research community is now moving on to looking at more positive effects, the more social aspects of gaming, games and learning, that sort of thing.
Yeah, because that stuff's happening, right? You can't
exactly. You
can't ignore it.
Exactly.
These things are popping up everywhere and people are using them in ways that we never really imagined. So we need to find out what's going on.
And I think there's also a new generation of researchers there. I think, you know, in the beginning, there were some effects researchers, old school people, you know, doing the research in that field. And nowadays, you have a lot of people that have firsthand experience with digital games. So that is a bit different, you know, because then they know this is not all evil. They know also the positive effects. They know sometimes it's a waste of time. Sometimes it's interesting, great, fun. But they understand it as a normal medium, I think. And a lot of my colleagues that are in the field have a very kind of a balanced approach to video games these days. And I think this is also kind of an age effect in science in a way, you know, that you have younger people coming into the field and having new and interesting ideas.
Yeah, that was also going to be one of my questions. How much do you think it's a factor of the people doing these research and the people who are approving grants and the people sort of setting agendas for departments? Like, these are people that grew up with Mario and the Doom Marine and you know, in video games in general, and they're more interested in that. Is that a factor?
I think this is a factor, yes. And I mean, you don't have to be a gamer. You know, you don't have to play 10 hours of games a day to do research on games. But I think firsthand experience is important to understand it in a way, to have access also to gamer communities and understand how they work. If you have, for example, sociological questions, it's really important to know who these communities are and not just look at it like some foreigner traveling to some exotic country and looking at the natives and that person doesn't understand anything because that person doesn't know what's happening in these communities. So really having that access and having that knowledge is quite helpful, I think. And I think in the long run, this also changes the whole approach to the field and also probably the funding, because researchers that are 30, 40 now, 50, well, they will be 50, 60, and 70, and they will be probably in power in 10, 20 years and decide on grants. So I think it's a kind of age effect or normal effect that you have in research that fields are changing also with the people and the experiences of people.
Mm-hmm. I think it normalizes the behavior. I mean, having grown up with Mario from a very early age, I mean, all my friends played games of some kind. I mean, it's a very normal behavior versus someone who was 50 when games came out. They may still see it as, what is this, you know, weird thing that, like my father would say, people are wasting their time playing these games, you know? It makes a big difference on your approach, I think, for researching this media. And yeah, we're seeing the gap between the researchers and maybe the grant givers, which may also explain why the main debates on violence and addiction and that sort of thing are the ones getting the money.
But I think it's important, again, you don't have to be a hardcore gamer. And you don't right. have to be a supporter of the industry or anything like that, because that's very often what the critics of games say, you know, that researchers that are more kind of neutral, they're, you know, kind of paid by the industry or whatever. They played games for too long and now they just don't know reality, you know. I think you can be skeptical. I wouldn't deny aggression effects. I mean, the short-term aggression effects of games, there's a lot of research on that. Not so sure about the long-term effects. And I wouldn't deny that there's a small group of gamers that could get addicted to games. I mean, we have done some research on that. It's a very small group, but I wouldn't deny that. But on the other hand, I don't say, you know, because of that, games have to go away. They won't go away. And this is, this is kind of a ridiculous wish. And some people are really on a mission here. And I think research should be really neutral and have an open eye for what is out there in the field.
So looking over the chapter listings in the book, you know, I see, like we said, a lot of stuff on aggression and addiction and communities and education and improving cognitive abilities, forming better behaviors and all that sort of stuff. And I can see how that would be of great interest to, say, for example, policymakers, including parents who are setting policies for their own house. I could see how it would be important to gamers, the people playing the games. What value in these debates do you think there is for people making games, for game developers and designers?
That's the Richard Bartle question, because he always asks that questions at our workshops and conferences. What can designers learn from your research?
Yeah, what's the answer?
Well, the answer is I think a lot of designers are interested in research because they want to understand, for example, how people react to games, what is the fun of gaming? Where does the fun come from? How can I build a game that is more interesting for certain groups? And if you produce a game for, you know, for health, it's important to know how the game can improve health problems or learning games, for example. If I want to have an effective learning game, it's good to have some research on that. How does it work? How can I get better learning effects from games? So I think there's a lot of meat in the book, a lot of stuff that you can learn from the book, even if you're a designer.
Okay, Rachel, anything to add?
What he said. No, I think, I think especially the games and learning chapter. I mean, Cishan Green did a really good job at really breaking down, you know, how these mechanisms work and how you can learn from games and what are the best modalities in which you can acquire new skills and new information.
Now, that all said, and which I personally agree with and sounds correct, I think that there's still a lack of good research on sort of the nuts and bolts of game design and game marketing and that type of thing. It seems that like there's not a lot of research out there and not a lot of debate to maybe spurn the research around, like, how do you get people to make in-app purchases? You know, how do you get them to buy that cosmetic item? How do you get them to keep playing, you know, the game? How do you get them to market the game to their friends? And a lot of this sounds sort of nefarious, and maybe it is, but, you know, if the answer to how do you get them to keep playing a game is that you make it, you know, intrinsically motivating and fun, then that's less sinister, or at least sounds less sinister. But there's not a whole lot of research around the types of things that game developers are interested in when they come in the morning and try to solve a specific task. And we're starting to see a little bit more of that and a little bit more interest. But, you know, I hope maybe in the sequel that you guys publish to this book in a few years that that there is stuff on that. Then there's more stuff around, you know, microtransactions and sharing and like how people, for example, fit mobile games into their days and like what are the behaviors of mobile games versus PC and console games that. You know, what are the design features that elicit different psychological responses and so forth? So that's not really a question. It's more just an observation.
Yeah, I mean, that would be really, that'd be, you know, version two for the designers.
Yeah, there you go.
But it's also kind of a, how do you say that? Is it a touchy subject, you know?
Sure.
Because, for example, micropayments, there's some ethical questions, connected to micropayments in a way. So I think a lot of people are a bit afraid to do some research on that, especially research that is helpful for the industry, because they could be blamed for, you know, helping the industry squeezing the money out of little children. You know, so I feel that is kind of a problem here, that a lot of researchers are a bit afraid of the reactions they could get for doing such research. Mm-hmm. And when it comes to the design questions, these are very often very practical questions. So I think there are some study programs out there, you know, you can study games design, and I think they do really good work there, but very often it's more practical knowledge. So it's not really published in the books, but they do their practical courses there, and that knowledge is not really transferred into kind of reflection in scientific books.
But back to your point about worrying about the perception, you know, the optics. So as we say about that type of research, that's true. You may not want to be like the first person to come out and be like, here's how you manipulate children into spending 99 cents at a time.
Yes.
But, you know, back in the 1970s, there was a big swell, for example, on research using credit cards and how that led to impulse purchases and how it distorted people's views of how much they spent. And that's really valuable research, and it can actually be used to help combat spending problems, right? So changing the way that you perceive spending, changing the way that you set up mental accounts for money and the transparency of the payment methods. Like, that's research that could be used for nefarious purposes and to squeeze more money out of people, or it could be used to educate them and allow them to come at purchases on their own terms. So I take your point, but I still think there's a big need.
Yeah. I mean, there's a really good South Park episode about microtransactions.
I love that episode.
That's all I can think of right now.
What debates do you think that we'll be having in 5 years or 10 years down the line? You know, when video games continue to develop and as people continue to do research, are there any emerging or new debates that you think we'll be looking at?
I think that we might see more of the debates into the social aspects of gaming, which is my field of research. I think as online gaming, I don't know if I would quite call it mainstream yet, but it is becoming more popular. And as it becomes more popular, I think we're going to be seeing maybe a little more vocalization and debate as to, you know, the psychological value or the psychological impact of interacting with people in mediated spaces. Mm. Just personally, that's what I think. I don't know.
I think I agree with Rachel that the social aspects of gaming will be very important. So far, we have done a lot of research that is looking at gamers as if they're just, you know, as if there's just one gamer out there, one person playing a game and not interacting with anybody else. And I mean, if you look at games nowadays, most of the games are really played together with other human persons and not just against an AI. What I also think is, some of the technologies and things that are developing nowadays might be a big issue or a big research topic in the future. For example, the use of mobile games. I think there's not enough research on that. And also research on VR, because I've been at the Gamescom, and at Gamescom there were a lot of technologies that they have shown there and things that were really interesting. Not just Oculus Rift, but also other VR, technologies that might be very interesting for gamers. And, you know, there are a lot of questions for research then, for example, when it comes to immersion or really deep immersion, when you really feel you're in the game and this changes your whole perception of a game in a way, because you cannot distance yourself from the game environment in the same way that how you can do that if you sit in front of a TV screen. But if you're really in the game, it's really different. I mean, you have to use Oculus Rift or some of these technologies to really feel the difference. But if you do, you really know it's something. Also, the quality is different of the experience. So I think if that trend continues, that might be a big topic for research in a few years.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. The virtual reality and augmented reality research, it just seems like if you're a researcher, you don't need to spend tens of thousands of dollars to equip your lab with a virtual reality setup when you can go buy an Oculus Rift or a competitor for a few hundred. And you can start doing research on that sort of stuff. So
yeah, absolutely. I mean, I will order some for my lab.
Yeah.
Oh, no. I'm jealous.
Yeah, I still haven't actually gotten to use an Oculus or any of those types of products. It seems difficult to understand the big deal about it, though, without actually being able to plop it on your head and see how it works and experience it firsthand.
Yeah, I mean, it's weird because before I used it, I had the impression that nobody's sitting in their home with that thing on their head, but if you use it the first time, you really understand this is different and this might be big. Well, if you survive it, basically, because some people don't, get along very well with, how do you say that? If they use Oculus Rift, they get sick.
The motion sickness. Did that happen to you?
Well, not me, but I know quite a few people, and I know some colleagues did some research with Oculus Rift, and they had problems in their lab because they had to clean up the lab the experiments. So, you know what I'm talking about.
So have buckets of sawdust handy to.
Oh no!
Yeah.
Yeah. Although apparently that's getting a lot better from what I've heard.
No, it's getting better. I think the synchronization is a big issue, but also the question of the synchronization of your motion with the image that you have there. I think that is a bigger issue because that's not only a technical issue, because even if the tracking is really good, still your own movement is not kind of synchronized to the movement in the game. So I think a lot of game mechanics need to adapt to the technology, because you cannot run around in an Oculus Rift game like in a normal shooter. That would be really bad for your health, I guess.
Yeah, unsafe, yeah. Yeah.
Not only unsafe, but also probably problematic for your living room in a way.
And just not fun.
Yeah.
No, absolutely not.
Yeah,
my hope is that game developers' memories are long enough to learn the lessons from like motion controls. You know, like when the Nintendo Wii came out, they were like, fling your arms around to throw a grenade and your Kinect camera will see it. And people hated that, and it's been phased out. So hopefully the game designers working with virtual reality and augmented reality will look at it and say, okay, what new experiences can we build from the ground up, instead of just saying like, it's a first person shooter, but now everything is totally surrounding you.
Like, right. Like
the more successful games, I think, will be ones that take better advantage. And that's going to require, research and experimentation.
Exactly.
So do you think these debates will ever get settled? Do you think we'll ever get to a point where we say, here's definitively what we know about aggression in games or addiction or how to use games to build communities, or whether or not games improve your cognitive functions. Like, is that stuff, you know, or is somebody going to be able to just point to a page in a book and say, here you go?
Well, I mean, I think at some point the research is just going to become so overwhelming, we're going to have to pick a side. I mean, there's already a lot of research in the area, but just like with television, it was a long time before we agreed that television won't completely ruin your life if you watch a little bit TV every night. But in the beginning, people were very concerned. So I think maybe 5 years, 10 years from now, we may see some of these debates. We'll see new ones come up, but maybe we'll finally see some of them being settled.
So I think there's a fine line between settling and just giving up.
And just, well, I don't know if it's giving up, but
picking aside.
Picking aside, exactly. I think collectively, at some point, we will pick aside.
Well, I think also we learned a lot of, you know, a lot of things about games already. I mean, if you look at the early literature, they were treating the gamers like robots. You know, humans are robots. You play a game, it's aggressive, and that person reacts in the same way. You know, it's really just copying the behavior from the game. And I think that is something that nobody believes in nowadays. Even the critics of games wouldn't say that humans react to games in such a simple way. Or at least if they believe that's true, they wouldn't say that at the scientific conference, because everybody would be laughing. You know, humans are more complex, and we learned that from the research, that we do not react to aggressive, or violent content in such a simple way. It depends on the situation. It depends on the context. It depends on the gamer and the game. And so there is not one answer, how people, you know, people, meaning everybody, reacts to a game, because everybody's a bit different. So we cannot give a definite, you know, an answer for every single person, how that single person reacts to that. We can just give that answer for larger parts of society, or specific types of gamers, or specific games. So we are getting closer to, I think, a better description, and also asking better questions. Not necessarily that we can answer all these questions, but I think there's a big value in science if you learn to ask the right questions. And I think in the beginning we were asking the wrong questions.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. And I also want to say that I think that some of the debates are maybe closer to resolution in the scientific community than in the public, which is part of the reason that we put this volume together. So hopefully that the overviews that are provided on the different topics in this volume can try and settle some of the debates that we're still seeing in the public.
Okay. So assuming that research is out there, it's going on and it's being done, what do you think that psychologists, communications research, and other academics can do to sort of make that matter and to sort of contribute more to the wider stage around, you know, policy and education systems and legislation and restrictions around marketing and even like promotion of games for when they can have benefits? Like, how do those researchers get involved? What do they need to do? I imagine step one, write a book called The Video Game Debate.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's about disseminating the information. We have a lot of information in the scientific community about games. As Thorsten said, we're asking better questions. You know, we have more than 10 years backlog of research, and it's, you know, behind paywalls, or it's filled with jargon that the average person can't understand. So we have to get better at, you know, disseminating the information in a way that people can not only access it, but also understand it, which is why we wrote the book. So.
Yeah, and I think that you have to get out of the ivory tower in a way. And I think it's pretty easy actually to do that. You can do a press release if you have a really interesting research project and you have some interesting findings. You can talk to the press. You can talk to people. I mean, you can go to parents and talk to them about your findings. I did that very often. I went to schools we also released press releases for our research, and you had some reaction to that. It's just that a lot of researchers aren't doing that because it's not really, it's not really valued inside the scientific system. because it doesn't really contribute to your career in a way. Because if you apply for a job, probably people are asking, you know, how many journal publications do you have, not how many press releases do you have. You know, that's kind of an issue, and it's also an issue that a lot of our colleagues think that if you're in the public, your research must be or is probably not as serious as the research that is, you know, just in journals, just for the ones that are in the know. So
that seems so backwards to me. Like,
because
like
it
the
is.
the value of your research.
Is, yes.
Yeah, the value of your research should be determined by how many people is it helping.
I 100% agree with you.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
Me too.
Well, great. The three of us will change the world. We'll do it.
Well, I still hope.
Yep.
Well, you know, kind of I've kept you guys longer than I promised I would, so I think we can start wrapping up. Is there anything else you wanted to tell us about the book? Or if not, just give us one last plug. Give me the title and where people can find it when.
The Video Game Debates will be available to purchase on Amazon on September 25th. Well, actually, you can pre-order it now on Amazon, but it will be released on September 25th. And we hope that you find it interesting. And I hope that it helps settle some of the debates that we're having in the public about digital games and its potential positive and negative effects.
Yeah, it has a wonderful, colorful cover.
Oh, it has a wonderful cover.
Absolutely. Yes. Yes. And yeah, people should read it, and they might love it, they might hate it, but I hope they learn something from it.
Last couple of questions to wrap things up, something I always ask my guests. What have you been playing lately?
Oh, I have an 8-month-old baby. I don't play very much. last game I played was The Sims 4.
Okay.
I have to admit it. I played Hearthstone. This World of Warcraft game on an iPad. That's highly addictive. I just,
yes.
I shouldn't play that. I think the last one I played on a console was Rayman with my kids.
Oh, that's a good one.
Yeah, I love it.
Yeah, I think I was lucky to have a bad experience with Hearthstone off the bat. and I sort of avoided learning how good and addictive a game it is. You know, it was one of those situations where I had a really frustrating experience with my first match against another human and then sort of repeated that a couple of times. It's like, oh, I'm no good at this, so I'm going to play something else.
Get off easy.
Yeah. Okay. And if people wanted to find out more about you and the research you're doing or just check out what's going on, where would they go on the internet to do that?
I have a website. It's rkowert, rkowert.com, if you want to learn more about me and my work.
Yeah, and you will find me at the Institute of Communication Studies at the University of Münster, or you just Google me, I think you might find me.
Okay, and I'll include links to those and your names with all the correct spelling on the blog entry that goes with this podcast and in the show notes as well, so people can check that out.
Excellent.
All right. Great. Well, thank you very much again for taking the time to come on here and talk to me about all the work you're doing and sort of the big picture stuff. It's nice to look at the big picture sometimes without getting lost in the weeds.
Oh, definitely. Thanks for having us.
Absolutely.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Okay, great. Take care. Okay. By law, I have a few seconds now to tell you about my Patreon campaign. Patreon.com is a system that allows people like you to support this podcast and the website by donating as little as $1 or $2 a month. This helps me pay for stuff I need to do the podcast and write the articles and keep all that going. Plus, you get Patreon-only benefits like early access to podcasts and access to audio versions of articles. So go to patreon.com/POG, that's for Psychology of Games, to get more information. Okay, we're done. Thanks for reaching the end of another Psychology of Games podcast. If you enjoyed this, or heck, even if you didn't, here's a few things you can do at psychologyofgames.com/podcast that costs you nothing but will help me out a lot. Find the link to subscribe to the podcast in iTunes or your other podcatcher of choice. Or you can just search for Psychology of Games in whatever you use to manage your podcast. Follow the link to iTunes and give me a rating or review. This helps get the podcast promoted on iTunes and brings in lots of new listeners.
Follow me on Twitter, Facebook, or RSS, which will get you notified when a new article or a podcast gets posted. And, of course, you can kick a dollar or more my way via Patreon. The link to patreon.com/POG is there as well. So thanks again, and I will see you next episode.